Peter chapter 4. We are continuing to think of ourselves as strangers and pilgrims, foreigners, because we belong to a different planet. We are Christians, we serve the Lord, and that has all sorts of consequences to us in our life. And part of those consequences is that we are not looked favorably upon by worldlings. They don't understand us and often don't like what we do, what we stand for, and who we are. And so a lot of what Peter talks about is how we deal with the persecution that comes when we live a godly life. And in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. The first thing he says about the persecution in this passage is, don't let it surprise you. In other words, this ought to be expected. You should have known that this fiery ordeal of persecution would come on you. It's interesting, he uses the same verb he used in verse 4. They are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. So our reaction to the world's attitude toward us shouldn't be the same as their reaction toward what we do. They're going to be surprised that we aren't like they are, but we're not surprised at all that they reject, ridicule, and in some cases even physically persecute us. This is right in line with predictions Jesus made. It's right in line with how the prophets in the Old Testament suffered and so forth. We should expect there's going to be opposition from the world to the way that we live. There are a lot of modern ideas that suffering isn't normal for a Christian and should be avoided at all costs. But people who say that haven't read the Bible. We would only expect that there would be a lot of suffering for those of us who follow Jesus. What kind of life did he live? How much did he suffer if we're his followers? Why would we be expected to be treated better than what he was? He says, this is not some strange thing that's happening to you. So how should we respond? Well, in verse 13, but to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exultation. There's some reasons why, though this is a little bit of a surprising idea, there are some reasons why we should rejoice at the suffering and persecution. For one thing, these are the sufferings of Christ. And it's a joy to share anything with Christ. And it's a joy to suffer for him. It's a way of showing our love for him, our loyalty to him. And certainly, it joins us together with him. And not only that, we always rejoice anticipating the joy we're going to have at his return. We have a sense of joy in our lives because we have so much to look forward to. And so no matter what's going on in this life, we're rejoicing as we think about what's coming next and the reunion we'll have with the Lord soon. Now, he says, if you're reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. Now, he goes from how we ought to respond to the persecution to the proper reasons for being persecuted. I mean, there are times when servants of the Lord just act badly and they get persecuted for that or rejected for that. This is not some rationalization for being an ornery or insulting person and, well, I'm just suffering for my faith. You know, there are times when Christians can be just jerks and they suffer because of that. That, there's no glory in that. There's no joy in that. There's no value in that. He says if you're a murderer or a thief or an evildoer, even if you're just somebody who can't mind your own business, you know, if it's because you're really not acting right that you're suffering, well, don't try to use this to glory in those things. You know, let's make sure that we're suffering because of our faith and not because we don't act properly. It's easy to rationalize if we're just misbehaving. Well, you know, I'm just suffering as a Christian. He says, well, check that. Make sure that's the case. But he says, but if anyone suffers as a Christian, verse 16, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. You know, the brethren themselves did not normally use that term to describe themselves. We often do. We talk about being a Christian probably more than we use any other term. But the first Christians used terms like disciples and saints and brethren, and it seems to me from the three times the word Christian is used in the New Testament that that was more something that outsiders called them. They were first called Christians in Antioch in Acts 11:26 in a context where the Gentiles were being converted, and really people were starting to see them as not just some kind of branch of Judaism, but they realized they were something different, and Christian was a logical thing to call them. Agrippa said, almost you persuade me to be a Christian. And then here, if anyone suffers as a Christian, if they're trying to shame you by using the term Christian, well, really, that's an honorable thing. They may be using it to try to ridicule you and put you down. But would there be a better thing you'd want to suffer for than to be a Christian? We should glorify God in this name. Now, you can understand that it must have been embarrassing on one level for honest Christians to feel suspected, to be bad-mouthed and maligned, to be arrested and imprisoned and condemned as evildoers. Can't you imagine that was embarrassing on one level? You know, where were you last week? Well, I was in jail. I mean, we wouldn't usually brag about that. But if we're in jail or we're just being slandered for our faith in Christ, he says, don't be ashamed of that. In fact, glorify God in this name. He says you can turn this into a name of honoring God. It's a blessing. It's something to be proud of in one sense. That you can wear the name of Christ and people are slandering you for that. So how should we respond when people put us down or they in some way seek to harm us because we're Christians? Well, let's glorify God in that name. Let's rejoice in that. And certainly, don't think that's unusual. Don't think that's strange. Don't think that you're suffering something above and beyond the call of duty. That's how disciples of Christ should expect to be treated. Now, he says in verse 17, for it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, What will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Now, he's saying judgment starts with God's own people, but the judgment he's speaking about here is the hostile reaction of the worldlings. And so if we have to go through this ordeal of persecution and suffering, what will the people in the world one day have to face? You know, they're going to get a lot worse than we are. If going through the sufferings we go through in this life is hard for us, can you imagine how it's going to be for them one day? That's the point that he's making. You know, I mean, there are times when you see non-believers that are popular and prosperous and at least apparently happy, and they get to do a lot of fun stuff, and it can be something where you feel almost resentful and jealous, and wow, I wish I could be like them. I mean, it's just, they just have it so good. Everybody likes them. Nobody ever speaks about them. You know, and they get to do all the stuff they want to do. I mean, you can get to where you start feeling like, wow, man, it sure is hard to do what I'm doing. Well, just think a minute. What if you could just swap and you could be them and they be you? Would you really want that? Well, maybe for a few minutes. But their lives are empty, no matter what their painted smile shows. But worse than that, they're going to receive the judgment of God. And the suffering you're getting now is nothing compared to the suffering they'll get then. We wouldn't want to trade places. He's saying, you think it's hard, that there's difficulty in your life as a Christian? Well, you sure don't want to face what they will have to face. There's kind of this myth that thinks that if you come to Christ, your life's going to get easier. You know, if you'll just be a Christian, it's a breeze. Well, that's not really true. I mean, that's not what the Scriptures teach at all. They're teaching that, yeah, in this life, you don't fit in, and you don't belong, and they don't like you, and it's not easy. God was not saying, here's the easiest life you can live. Just serve me. It's the best life. It's the right life. But Peter's warning a lot about don't be expecting it to be easy. But what do we do in verse 19? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. That's what we do. If we suffer according to the will of God, let's entrust ourselves to the faithful Creator. He'll do the right thing. We can trust Him, and we can just entrust ourselves to Him. When He says entrust your souls, I believe He's using that term like He does several times in 1 Peter. He doesn't mean just entrust the immaterial part of you, just entrust your spirit. He's saying entrust your person, entrust your whole life to Him. Soul here in the sense of a people, not in the sense of just one part of us. You can entrust everything you've got to the Lord, and He'll take care of us. And then He gives instructions to elders. It's a bit hard to understand in this context how He makes that transition. I'm not sure if perhaps elders might be, as leaders of God's people, more likely to suffer persecution, or if maybe in difficult times of persecution it's more important that we have good shepherds to guide us. But at any rate, He says, therefore, I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you. Now, Peter is writing to these shepherds from a very sympathetic perspective. He is a fellow elder. This is elder to elder, or shepherd to shepherd. He understands the responsibilities and the pressures and whatever all goes in with being a faithful shepherd of God's flock. And he's also a witness of the sufferings of Christ. So he's got a lot of reason to exhort them. And what does he say? He says to these shepherds to shepherd the flock, to feed the flock. It's the flock of God. So those who serve as elders, overseers, shepherds of God's people are not dealing with just any sheep. This is God's flock. It's His property. And it's so important that God's shepherds treat them and guide them and care for them with the kind of care and concern that you would as you're dealing with God's sheep, God's property, His special possession. There's a lot of responsibility in being a shepherd. You know, we had those lessons back in February with the two brethren from Atlanta that helped us think about that more. But that's a huge responsibility because it's God's flock. And he talks about some things that a shepherd ought to do as he exercises the oversight of this flock. Kind of what to and not to do. He said, not under compulsion, but voluntarily. You know, a shepherd shouldn't do it out of obligation or because somebody has to do it and nobody else will, so I guess I will. It shouldn't be thought of like that. It shouldn't be something that we see as a burden. Nothing we do in the service of God should be thought of as a burden. We shouldn't think of anything as like, guess I got to teach this Bible class. I can't find anybody else to. You know, I guess I'll have to lead songs tonight. Or I guess I'll have to do whatever. You know, I guess I'll have to, you know, go and sit with this sick sister. Or I guess I'll go and have to go and try to help so-and-so move or whatever. We ought to view everything we do in the service of God as a privilege, as a joy we want to serve. So this should not be a reluctant draftee who feels like, nah, I don't think I can get out of it. I'll just have to do it. No, he says, do it voluntarily. Do it because you want to shepherd God's flock. You care about them. And he says, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Don't do it for the money. Now, that might sound funny to us because it's not perhaps as common among us for shepherds to be paid as what it was for them. 1 Timothy 5 specifically talks about paying elders who work hard in the preaching and teaching. And I think the thing that's hard for us is if we have a very limited concept of the role of a shepherd. I grew up understanding the role of an elder to basically be kind of running the business of the church. So making sure there was people scheduled to do the lead the worship and kind of making the decision about what the money's spent for, and you know, just basic decisions have to be made for the group to work. And so your thought was, well, you know, every few weeks the elders meet together and you know, they make whatever decisions that need to be made for an hour or two or whatever. If there's a big thing going on, maybe it's a little bit more. But it doesn't seem like something you need much pay for. You know, just kind of work that into your time. But when you really stop and think about the role of shepherding the sheep, that's a lot more than making some business decisions about a church. It's really being involved with the individual members, guiding and directing and feeding and warning and caring for them and nurturing and bringing them up to maturity in Christ. You could well see where they could spend full time doing that and need paid. But that shouldn't be their motive for serving. Don't do it for the money. That's what he's saying. You ought to do it for eagerness, because you're eager to. And then in verse 3, not yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. Don't do it for the power. You know, some people like to run things and like to tell people what to do. You know, we got kind of that desire to dominate. And so you can see why there might be some elder who would like doing that because, wow, I get to tell everybody what to do. I get to get my way. I can boss other people around. Well, don't do it for that. You know, that's not the concept. It's not so you get to have your way. You're an example to the flock. You're guiding by your life and not thinking of this as a power trip. And he says in verse 4, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. It's interesting that the shepherds have a shepherd. And the chief shepherd, he's really the one in charge. And he'll provide the unfading crown of glory to elders who have worked hard to take good care of God's flock. God will reward our service as we serve him. You younger men, verse 5, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, for God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. There's a bit of a debate about this passage, but I think it's best to understand that he's talking about younger people and their need to submit to the elders, the shepherds. I don't know that there's just some idea of, you know, older people are just to be submitted to, but those who are to be submitted to are those who have been appointed as elders. But you know who has the hardest time doing that a lot of times are younger people who may not see the wisdom in the older men who've been appointed to lead and guide the flock. Sometimes when you don't have a lot of experience, you think you know pretty much everything. And so there's a reason he would say, perhaps especially to the younger ones, make sure you're submitting to the elders. But really, this is not something that is only to younger people. Really, we need to be humble toward each other. Mutual humility of all the brethren. We need to respect one another and not be trying to impose our will or asserting ourselves or trying to get attention and applause. Humility ought to be what we're wearing. You know, it ought to just be our life and our way of thinking that is so contrary to our culture. We just really kind of almost admire the braggarts. You know, the guy who throws his weight around and the guy who makes sure he gets noticed and you know, he works his way up to the top. You know, we almost would pull that person out as the model. You know, you'd be like him. Because that's kind of what we all secretly admire. So we have to really stop and think. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's something to reflect on a lot. It's so hard for us, even in practice, to think about what being humble toward each other means in our life. And God says it over and over again. He says it in such important contexts. But it's just one of those things that we've got to really keep uppermost in our mind, keep praying about, and keep trying to see ways in which we exalt ourselves when we ought to be abasing ourselves. So he's telling these brethren how to deal with persecution. He's also dealing with those who guide the Christians in persecution, the elders. I'd like for us to reread this section, and then we'll stand and sing. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or a troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will be the what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. Therefore, I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive receive the unfading crown of glory. You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders. And all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Let's stand.